This is The Takeaway for Thursday, November 16th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. And let's begin in Washington, where today House Republicans passed a massive tax bill that amounts to over $1.4 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade. House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republicans have been working on this bill for years. In many ways, these huge tax cuts define what it means to be a Republican.
Read my lips. No new
with a government serving the people, not the other way around.
Everybody does benefit when government takes less from the people.
You can't raise taxes.
It is outrageous to suggest that raising taxes is a good idea.
We must give overcharged taxpayers some of their own money back.
A massive tax cut.
We've got to get out of the game of Washington picking winners and losers in the tax code.
To deliver this giant win for the American people, and begin middle-class miracle.
Tax cuts are Republican dogma, even in an era when the party's leader, President Donald Trump, seems to be scorching the rest of the GOP identity in a fire filled with tweets and insults and friendly gestures toward Russia. Listen to President Ronald Reagan here, 1981, and you get a sense from this icon of conservatism what low taxes mean to Republicans.
We will restore the freedom of all men and women to excel and to create. We will unleash the energy and genius of the American people, traits which have never failed us.
What you just heard there is a moment that Paul Ryan still talks about from a president he talks about all the time. So how did American politics come to hate taxes so very much? Do American voters hate taxes as much as their politicians do? Molly Mitchell-Moore is professor at Washington and Lee University and author of Tax and Spend, The Welfare State, Tax Politics, and the Limits of American Liberalism. Molly, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Also with us, Vanessa Williamson, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Vanessa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Vanessa, do Americans actually like paying taxes?
Well, in my book, I talk about their pride in taxpaying, and so it's not the same thing to be proud and to be happy. But Americans talk about being taxpayers in a very specific way. They use it as a kind of shorthand for being an upstanding, contributing person. So, you know, even when I was at rallies for the Tea Party, a group that was very angry about what they thought government was doing, I'd regularly hear people say, as a taxpayer, I... And the end of that sentence was never about taxes. It was always about their right to be heard. So Americans see taxpaying as a really important part of their civic responsibilities, a kind of evidence for their deservingness to participate.
There's even this American shorthand, isn't there? Work hard, pay your taxes. I work hard, pay my taxes.
Exactly.
Well, Molly, Vanessa says Americans are proud to pay taxes even if they don't like writing the check or seeing the withholding. But people who do hate paying taxes, Molly, probably feel like they have a home in the Republican Party. Was it always so?
The Republican Party has never been a fan of the federal income tax. But when I started my research, what I was sort of interested in was this question about how and why taxes did move to the center of American politics in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And what I was surprised to find was that from the very beginning, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, had sort of pursued a low tax agenda, right? So even the so-called tax and spend liberals in the Democratic Party had been much happier to provide tax cuts rather than tax hikes.
I mean, is that as simple as the good politics of taking a hardworking family and saying, oh, you have $1,200 more now? That seems like pretty basic good politics.
It was good politics. And it was also good politics that worked for a specific moment in American history. So the Democratic Party is the dominant party after the Second World War. And after the Second World War, we have this extraordinary period of economic growth that produces extraordinary federal tax revenues. So the federal government is able to take in a lot of money at the same time as it's cutting taxes in this post-war period. And Democrats are able to sort of redistribute that to their constituents. But all of that comes to an end when that great economic boom comes to an end in the late 1960s. And that provides the Republican Party, which had basically been in the wilderness since the 1920s, to make a move, right, to become a majoritarian party again.
So, Molly, when you see this project now on Capitol Hill, a tax cut hovering around $1.5 trillion and all the unequivocal promises Republicans like Speaker Paul Ryan are making to get the bill done now. What do you see in this political moment?
In some ways, it seems to be a kind of zombie Reaganism, right? You mentioned in the intro that Paul Ryan is very fond of citing Ronald Reagan and citing the arguments that Reagan and the supply-siders that gathered around him in the early 1980s made about the ways in which the tax system was stifling American ingenuity, was stifling prosperity. And so that was the argument that in some ways made sense in the early 1980s, but it makes less sense now.
Vanessa, so sticking on Capitol Hill for a moment, I mean, the tax bill that's passing the House today polls miserably. Only 25% of voters in a poll that I saw this morning said they support the bill, and yet Republicans feel the need to press and press hard on this. How do you interpret those politics?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me even more than the very low support overall is the fact that they only have 60% of Republican support when you ask about Republican support for the Republican tax plan. And in these highly partisan times, you'd really think they could get better numbers than that. So yeah, the level of support you're seeing for this bill is exceptionally low. And, you know, that really, to me, says something about the way they've approached this legislation. They have not done what Reagan did. They have not done what even George Bush did to pass tax cuts, which is to put up front very obvious benefits that will reach a lot of individuals. Instead, there's real uncertainty about what's going to happen for most taxpayers, most individual taxpayers. The only thing that's clear is there's a big tax cut at the very top.
And do you have any sense from voters, from public opinion, from middle-class people that they were clamoring for a tax cut when Republicans got elected? Is that what they were demanding from their Congress?
There is very, very little clamor for a tax cut these days. If you ask Americans in the last decade what bothers them most about taxes, about 10% of people say that it's the amount that they pay. About two-thirds say either that corporations are not paying their fair share or that the wealthy are not paying their fair share and should pay more. So this legislation really addresses the opposite of the primary concerns of most Americans.
You just said that people are concerned that corporations and wealthy people don't pay their fair share. This bill cuts taxes for both those groups in a gigantic way.
That's exactly right. So there's really no line that can be drawn between what public opinion says and what this legislation includes. Now, it's not always the case. I mean, it's not always the case that legislation is the result of what the median voter would want, but this seems exceptionally far from even the preferences of the Republican base.
Molly, I want to talk about Republicans a little bit more because this is a party that's in crisis. Members are retiring and leaving. President Trump is upending the Republican Party's identity. So how important is delivering a huge tax cut now to capital R Republicanism, even if, as Vanessa says, individual voters, even Republican voters, aren't really clamoring for a tax cut?
Well, I think that Vanessa is right, that there is no real demand among the Republican base, at least not the Republican base of voters, maybe the Republican base of donors, for this kind of a tax cut. And so honestly, the politics of this tax cut elude me. You hear a lot of Republican lawmakers saying that this is their last gap, this is their last chance to get a win in 2017. But I honestly don't understand the upside, right? Vanessa's right. If you look at historic Republican tax cuts, either the Reagan tax cuts of 1981 or the George W. Bush tax cuts of the early 2000s, those were tax cuts that skewed towards the rich, but they also gave really meaningful benefits to people in the middle and even the working classes. And so they were a much easier sell. They were more popular. This tax cut, as far as I can tell, doesn't have anything in it for those folks.
Well, the other side of a giant tax cut is a lot of debt. This bill is projected to increase the national debt by, as I said, $1.5 trillion. Now, when President Obama was in office, the Republican Party did an awful lot of hand-wringing over the size of the debt. Really, it was constant. They're not talking about it anymore. Is this just political opportunism?
I would say so. The Republican Party, at least recently, seems to be much more interested in debts and deficits when Democrats are in the White House, and much less interested when Republicans are in the White House. And this is the case during the Reagan administration. It's the case during the George W. Bush administration, and it certainly seems to be the case now.
Vanessa, political opportunism over debt? I mean, one of the criticisms of modern conservatism that you hear a lot is that this long-term Republican project in cutting taxes is that if the debt goes up by a lot, it can put more pressure to cut entitlements later, Social Security, Medicare in particular. Eventually, the debt is so high, you get to a point where you say, sorry, we just can't afford it. We got to cut these programs. Do you buy it?
Well, I certainly buy that that's the rhetoric that you hear. And there's not great evidence that that kind of fiscal pressure actually ends up cutting entitlements. But it's certainly the political rhetoric that people who would like to cut entitlements use, right? So it eases the political argument, even if it doesn't ease actual cuts. But this year, I think that, you know, it's as Molly said, quite a remarkable year in that in the past, often we talk about tax cuts separate from benefit cuts. We act as if the money is kind of free. Right? That there's never going to be a consequence. But this year, the Republicans are actually moving forward big tax cuts for corporations and some wealthy people alongside really quite obvious benefit cuts for everyone else. So that connection that's sometimes a little bit hard to make in sort of public discourse is actually a lot clearer this time than usual.
The history and the politics of a gigantic $1.5 trillion tax cut from Republicans in a populist moment in America. Molly Mitchell-Moore, professor at Washington and Lee University, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Vanessa Williamson with Brookings, thanks for powering through your cold. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
As sexual harassment and abuse continue to dominate the national conversation, another allegation surfaced today. Radio newscaster Leanne Tweeden accused Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken of groping her and kissing her without permission when she was a model and a sportscaster on a USO tour in the Middle East in 2006. Franken at the time was working as a comedian and host on Air America Radio and was a frequent celebrity on USO tours. Franken says he does not remember the incident in the same way, but he apologized to Tweeden. And yesterday on the show, we talked about reporting sexual harassment and abuse in the workplace, and we got lots of stories from you. We're still getting them.
My name is Carrie Enneking, and I'm from Minster, Ohio. When I was 28 years old, I worked for a very large corporation, and my boss would come to my desk and rub up against me from behind, rub my shoulders. He would swipe his finger through the band of my skirt to search for my underwear. And it turns out there were 20 other women at the company. Someone finally came forward and I was able to tell my story, and I still feel a tremendous amount of shame and embarrassment that that happened to me, that I allowed it, and that I was powerless to stop it.
Keep sharing your stories with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a message on our Facebook page. And if you have a story similar to Carrie's, yesterday we talked to an expert about how to handle situations like this and how to think through whether to report sexual harassment or how. You can find that conversation on our website at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
To those who left me, who abandoned me in my darkest moment, I forgive you. To those who embraced me in my darkest moment, I love you. To those New Jerseyans who gave me the benefit of the doubt, I thank you.
That's an emotional Democratic Senator Bob Menendez there addressing reporters after the judge declared a mistrial in his federal corruption case. Jurors deadlocked after nearly 4 days of deliberation in a trial that started more than 2 months ago. This is the first time in a generation that the Justice Department has brought federal bribery charges against a sitting U.S. senator. Joe Hernandez is a reporter for WHYY. He's been covering the trial, and he joins us now from Newark, New Jersey. Joe, thanks for being on.
Thanks, Todd.
Joe, a mistrial isn't an acquittal for Bob Menendez. How much of a victory is this for him?
Well, the defense team certainly saw it as a victory. They were high-fiving and hugging each other afterwards. Menendez hugged his kids, and during the remarks he made outside the courthouse, he teared up several times. And if you listen to that speech that he made, it sounds a lot like a victory speech. But you're right, the federal government could retry the case if they wanted to, since it ended in a mistrial. They issued a brief statement, but haven't said yet whether they'd retry the case or not.
These were 12 felony counts, is that right, against Bob Menendez and his friend? Can you remind us briefly what the charges were?
It was 12 counts against Menendez and 11 against his friend, and that's because there was an extra tacked on for Menendez for omitting some of these gifts from his annual Senate financial disclosure forms. But generally speaking, the charges were bribery and corruption against these two men. Justice Department prosecutors said that they traded lavish gifts and trips and political contributions for government favors. Salomon Melgen, Florida eye doctor Salomon Melgen, gave Menendez free flights on his private jet, paid for vacations to Paris and the Dominican Republic, and gave hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions that benefited Menendez. And prosecutors say in return for all of that, Menendez gave Melgen access to the highest levels of federal government. He helped Melgen secure travel visas for his girlfriends. He helped Melgen try to sort out a Medicare billing dispute at his eye doctor practice. And he also intervened on Melgen's behalf in a contract dispute in the Dominican Republic.
Now, prosecutors weren't able, though, to connect the gifts to the official acts. And that's part of why they had a problem getting a conviction here. Joe, people have been watching this trial not only because of federal corruption charges against a sitting U.S. senator, but what it might mean for Bob Menendez's Senate seat if he had been convicted and might have had to resign. But here's Menendez talking to some of his political enemies.
To those who were digging my political grave so that they could jump into my seat, I know who you are, and I won't forget you.
Joe, there's going to be an ethics investigation in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, has announced that today. But Chris Christie, the Republican governor, only has, about 50 days left as governor. So a new trial probably won't unseat Menendez anytime soon, I guess.
Probably not. I mean, we don't know yet even when a new trial, if it happens, would occur. And you're right, there's this now pending ethics investigation of Menendez in the Senate. But he obviously is showing no signs of planning to resign. He has to run for re-election next year if he wants to keep his seat. In order to expel him from the Senate, you'd need a two-thirds majority vote, which means a bunch of Democrats, which seems unlikely at this point as well. And you mentioned that Chris Christie has only a couple months left as governor. New Jersey just elected a new governor who's a Democrat. So if any of this fallout actually occurred and Menendez, for whatever reason, was expelled from the Senate, if it happened more than 2 months from now, a Democrat would likely take his place anyway.
And Joe, I know you're not in the minds of prosecutors, but any sense of the chances of a new trial here?
Well, it entirely depends on them. I mean, I guess they'll consider this trial lasted 9 weeks, and then the jury had it for about 2 weeks with a couple of breaks and a couple and one restart. So it was a very lengthy endeavor, and they would have to retry the entire case with a new jury. And I would think that they'll probably take a step back, look at this case, and see what they think their chances are going forward. There were probably some members of the jury who were on their side. Again, this was a mistrial, not an acquittal. So the jurors just couldn't come to an agreement. It's not that they found these two men not guilty. So perhaps the prosecution will read into that they do have a chance and try the case again in the future.
A deadlocked jury and a mistrial for U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey on 12 federal corruption counts. Joe Hernandez of WHYY. Thanks, Joe.
No problem.
America got news of yet another mass shooting on Tuesday, this one in Northern California. Kevin Jansen Neal went on a rampage, killing 5 people and injuring several more before he was killed by police. Now, police originally thought there were 4 deaths, but Tehama County Assistant Sheriff Phil Johnston had this development on Wednesday.
We were looking for his wife. We couldn't find her yesterday. We located her dead body concealed under the floor of the residence last night. She was obvious victim of several gunshot wounds.
Neil, like many of the suspects behind recent mass shootings, had a history of domestic abuse and harassment of his neighbors. Now, federal law prevents people convicted of domestic abuse from buying guns. So how do people like Neil fall through the cracks and offend again, often with firearms, after they're already on law enforcement's radar? Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit news outlet focusing on gun-related reporting. Alex, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, in case after case, we see violent criminals, in this case, mass shootings, but not just mass shootings, that have a history of domestic abuse. So what do we know about the connection between domestic abuse and later violence, whether it's a big high-profile mass shooting or not?
You know, it's one of the clearest risk factors that clinicians have identified. A Duke psychologist, Jeff Swanson, told me people don't just start out committing murders. They tend to engage in escalating patterns of violence. And you might go from verbally abusing the people in your family to physically abusing them to physically harming strangers. So it's a very, very clear connection.
So violence predicts violence. The science is very, very clear on that,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So what does the law say about people who are convicted of domestic abuse and whether they can keep their guns or buy a gun later?
Well, federal law says that anyone who's committed a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence or any felony that has a jail term of a year or more, which covers a lot of felony crimes of domestic violence, or anyone who's been who's subject to a domestic violence restraining order is banned from owning guns or buying new ones. But it's not as simple as that. That's what the law says, but enforcement is a whole nother can of worms. It really comes down to state and local authorities to actually get the guns out of people's hands. They may not be able to pass a federal background check at a licensed gun dealer, but they may be able to keep a hold of guns they owned before they were prohibited. They may be able to buy from, you know, private individuals in a state that doesn't have universal background checks.
So, Alex, what it sounds like you're saying is that in the real world, yes, federal law says if you're convicted of domestic abuse, you can't have guns. But we're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of cases every day, unfortunately. And the cops aren't going to your home and knocking on the door and saying, hi, we're here for a sweep. Give us all your guns.
Right. It can, to a frustrating degree, operate on the honor system. I was speaking to a lawyer in California who files he works for a battered women's shelter, and he said, you know, we file a lot of restraining orders here. The judge will say at the end of the proceeding, do you have any guns? You know, you can't own any guns. And the defendant will say, no, I don't have any guns, or I understand I can't have any guns anymore, but that's the end of that. You know, only in a handful of places, Seattle increasingly is one, do cops actually go to a domestic abuser's home and say, and actually look for a gun.
If researchers, if the science has said that domestic abuse really does predict later violence, and the law says that you want to keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers, it seems like more law enforcement agencies would recognize an opportunity when there's a conviction to really prevent not only the big high-profile mass shootings that we always talk about, but some of the day-to-day violence that we hear about, where if a gun weren't in the room and you could predict the likelihood of some violent behavior in the future, maybe there's some prevention that could be done.
Yes, absolutely. There's a big opportunity there to actually get guns out of the hands of people who we already agree shouldn't have them. The issue is really one of resources. It's costly to send police to go execute these search warrants, and it can be dangerous. Police are more likely to be injured or killed on domestic violence-related calls than any other kind of call. So it's not without risks to law enforcement, but there's a lot of potential upside.
Alex, you talk about it as a question of resources, but I also wonder about the question of culture, not only around the true danger of domestic abuse, but also around guns themselves. Yes, there's a federal law that says a convicted abuser can't have guns. Maybe in a lot of police departments, they say, this is not really a reason for me to go and take someone's guns. They have constitutional right maybe to have guns.
You know, I couldn't say that I've come across such a explicit resistance, but there may be, you know, a kind of a lack of awareness that, you know, you really have to go that last mile. You know, judges may not realize that they're just kind of taking someone's say-so, or you know, I believe in this case in California, the local sheriff who is responsible for enforcing the restraining orders against the suspect, Mr. Neal, wasn't initially aware that he was prohibited from owning guns. Only later, when, you know, someone actually checked the court documents, did they come back and tell the sheriff that actually this guy should never have had any guns.
Talk about some of the loopholes in the real world that police or judges confront if a domestic abuser is banned from having guns. I mean, that person might be banned from having guns. They might live in a house with four other people.
Right. It may be difficult to ban them from possession of guns or living in the same home as guns. Probably one of the biggest, though, is that in the vast majority of states, 32 states, you can legally buy a gun from a private individual without going through a background check and what's called a private sale. In the entire country, if you buy a gun from a licensed dealer, no matter where you are, you have to go through a background check. But in 32 states, you can just buy it from a friend or someone that you arrange a sale with on the internet. There's a website called Arms List that's sort of like Craigslist for guns. There are also issues just with paperwork. Not every court system is going to make it clear in the same way that someone has committed a crime of domestic violence. They may have a charge for assault, and if you were to read the charging documents, you might say it might be clear that it was a domestic assault. But say if you're a background check examiner, you'd have to do extra work to see, oh, this was a domestic violence case. This person shouldn't be able to buy a gun.
The connection between domestic abuse and later violence and firearms in America. Alex Yablon with The Trace. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico nearly 2 months ago, but many people on the island are still living without power and improvising in their everyday lives to get by. Alana Casanova Burgess is a producer for WNYC, and she's been reporting in Puerto Rico for the past week. Alana, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what have you seen?
I'm seeing that people here are really frustrated still. They're frustrated that they don't have electricity, that they, in many cases, don't have water. And really, those are just the basics. On top of that, they're trying to figure out what their future looks like. Many businesses have shuttered here. People don't have jobs. And many plans that people had for, you know, the next steps in their lives are just completely ruined.
So, Alana, we've seen reports about how much of the island has power, but you've been watching people in their everyday lives just trying to manage.
Yeah. And what you've just said about how many people have power is important because in the States, you know, where I was before 10 days ago, I would hear all the time that something like 40% of Puerto Ricans had power. Now it's close to 50%, the government says. But that's not true here on the ground because that number that they're referring to is actually about electricity generated. It's not about the electricity that's getting to people's homes. The priority here are hospitals, water pumps, things like that. And so people's homes, for the most part, are not powered. And that's been really frustrating to people here to hear that in the States, we have a warped sense of what the conditions are like here on the ground. I spoke with Ilana Correa. She's a junior at the University of Puerto Rico in Río Piedras. And here's what she told me.
It's pretty difficult, you know, doing work. You know, because I have no laptop, internet is pretty much broken, and the only thing I really have in my house is water, and that's sometimes.
So she has water and not even all the time, and Alana, you've been spending some time in the homes of Puerto Ricans.
I have, yeah. So the other day I was in Isabela, which is a small coastal community in the northwest, and I was speaking with a few people out in the park in people's homes, and one concern there was even if the power came back, you know, last week, for example, for Raul Correa, who got electricity back for the first time on Friday, he's still really concerned about the water because it's coming out of his tap, but...
Estamos cogiendo agua del grifo, de la pluma,
y we're taking water from the tap, but we can't use it. You can't drink it because of the consequences. It carries serious diseases, and someone could have to go to the hospital or even die.
And what he's referring to there is leptospirosis, which is a waterborne bacterial infection that the government has been warning about here. You know, I get into the car and I hear radio ads all the time reminding people that they have to boil their water for at least 3 minutes before drinking it. And everyone I've spoken to says that the water comes and goes. So there's also this sense that at any moment you have to hoard water because it could be gone the next day. And the government here says that 90% of the population has running water. That's according to a website they have up called status.pr. But obviously you get here on the ground and you realize that that is not the experience that people are having.
What other moments have you seen that have really affected you while you've been there?
So the other day I was in Ciales and there was a band playing. So listen to this, Todd. There was a guy who got up. And there's a style of music here called pie forzado. It's sort of troubadour style improvised. So this guy starts singing about the hurricane. And he says, destroyed my Borinquen, which Borinquen is the name of the island here, Puerto Rico. So he says, gracias Padre Amado por la fuerza de mi gente. So thank you, beloved Father, for the strength of my people.
The sounds of everyday life in Puerto Rico as citizens there continue to try to recover after Hurricane Maria 2 months ago. Alana Casanova Burgess is with WNYC. Thanks, Alana.
Thank you, Todd.
And you can follow Alana's travels in Puerto Rico on her Twitter feed at Alana Lama. Back to taxes now. You know, earlier we talked about the culture of tax cuts in America and the House Republican tax bill. Meanwhile, senators have decided to replay an old favorite in their version of tax cuts. Obamacare repeal is back. Here's Senate Republican Whip John Cornyn of Texas.
Rather than buy the insurance that supposedly we want them to buy, we overprice it and then we penalize them when they can't afford it. So we are going to repeal the tax on poor Americans. It'll amount to about $43 billion over the next 10 years. That'll be a huge influx of money into their pocket that right now they're having to pay the federal government.
Now, John Cornyn there is talking about the individual mandate, that unpopular policy at the heart of the ACA that says that most people who don't get coverage through work or through the government have to buy it through Obamacare. Now, Republicans have tried and failed with ACA repeal before. You know that. Are they taking a big risk, including it in their all-important tax bill? Jennifer Habercorn is senior healthcare reporter for Politico Pro. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Todd.
Well, Jennifer, we've followed it. They have tried to get an ACA repeal before, of course. Why go after the individual mandate now?
Yeah, Obamacare repeal just keeps coming back. This time, Republicans are using it for tax reform because it raises a bunch of money. The CBO says it would give them $338 billion. They can take that money and apply it to other parts of tax reform. So really, as much as Republicans love the idea of getting rid of Obamacare, this really came down to the money here. They want to use that in tax reform.
Okay, easy to see how they want the money to pay for tax cuts. That's pretty simple. That's math. What about the effect on insurance markets and on the price of insurance? What would happen on the healthcare side?
So if you remember in 2012, the Supreme Court case was all about the individual mandate. And there was a lot of concerns at that time that this was going to kill Obamacare if the mandate went away. That's not really the case now. It's not quite as dire. The mandate has been around for a couple years. It hasn't had the effect that supporters of the ACA hoped it would. It really didn't bring a ton of people into the market. So there's not as much concern now that the mandate going away would ruin Obamacare, but these markets are pretty shaky. In a lot of places, there's only one insurance company offering plans, so they essentially have a monopoly, can charge whatever they want. And this will be just another reason for insurers not to participate in the Affordable Care Act.
But the mandate was supposed to be one of the legs of the stool, right? It was supposed to guarantee a market for insurers in exchange for all of these rules and reforms that they have to agree to under the ACA. And there are lots of benefits, things that they have to cover. You know, Jen, one of the arguments all along is that if the mandate goes away and all of the extra things you get under Obamacare don't go away, well, then premiums just shoot up.
Yeah, and that was the theory behind the mandate. But now that the mandate has been in effect for a couple of years, people have realized, economists have realized, the fine isn't really strong enough. It's $700, which in most cases is cheaper than getting insurance. So if you're really on the ropes and you have to make a decision, do I buy insurance or pay the mandate is cheaper. If the mandate were more money, it would be stronger. It would be more of a incentive to buy insurance. I'm not saying that eliminating the mandate would have no effect. It just wouldn't have the stark effect that the economists worried it back in 2012 that it would. And, you know, the markets, the insurers that are in the markets right now, they're pretty committed. A lot of them are the smaller insurers. The big insurers have already left. So if anything, this will be the final straw for insurers, but it's not going to be the make or break moment that we once worried getting rid of the mandate would.
Well, what are Republican senators saying, though, Jen? Several key senators have balked at lots of versions of ACA repeal before. We saw it. Could getting the tax bill into repeal territory be dangerous for this tax cut?
Oh, definitely. Anytime you get close to this, it's scary. And Senator John McCain, one of the senators who ended the GOP repeal effort over the summer, has not said whether he would support this. He did tell me when I asked him yesterday in the hallway of the Capitol that this isn't a deal breaker, but he didn't say that he's going to support it for sure.
And we're keeping an eye on several other senators as well. Of course, some familiar names like Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. You mentioned John McCain. Healthcare is now part of the tax cut bill in the Senate. Jennifer Habercorn, senior health reporter with Politico Pro. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Todd.
I would like to address recent news reports regarding meetings during the campaign attended by George Papadopoulos and Carter Page. Frankly, I had no recollection of this meeting until I saw these news reports. I do now recall that the March 2016 meeting at the Trump Hotel that Mr. Papadopoulos attended, but I have no clear recollection of the details of what he said at that meeting.
That's Attorney General Jeff Sessions there testifying before the House Judiciary Committee earlier this week, telling lawmakers why he was telling the truth when he said he knew nothing about campaign contacts with Russians. But George Papadopoulos and Carter Page now are among the dozen or so names that have been thrown into the escalating investigations by Congress and by Robert Mueller's special counsel looking into Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. Contact after contact with Russians, new reporting showing Russia may have cultivated a relationship with Donald Trump for years before he ran for president. It all makes it seem like former KGB man Vladimir Putin must have some highly orchestrated plan to disrupt American politics. Well, according to Russian journalist Mikhail Ziegler, more than a decade of reporting on the Kremlin shows that's not what's really going on in Moscow.
This wave of conspiracy theories that Putin is the man who's got the strategic vision and who has initiated such a huge plot against American democracy seems to me a bit of exaggeration. I have no doubts that there was Russian interference and President Putin doesn't like Hillary Clinton and wanted to create a mess during American electoral campaign. He wanted it to be much more chaotic. But I'm not really sure that there was that genuine strategy that is usually described in American media. He's not that James Bond style villain, you know. It seems to me a huge conspiracy theory that is not accurate in each and every moment.
Still, the aspects of what might comprise a grand theory, if the grand theory is inaccurate, they are real, right? Intentional fake news is real, and trying to recruit people, that's real,
definitely.
And bots
and
are real.
That's what we were watching inside Russia for many years. Those troll factories and a lot of companies which are creating fake news websites. That's the reality we've been living in for like more than a decade. So probably they decided that they can use it not only for domestic consumption, not only for Russian audience, but for American audience as well.
But looking into Vladimir Putin's history, you say that he's a man of opportunity, that he often behaves as a guy without a grand strategy, but as somebody who knows how to spot a chance and take it. What does that mean?
That's right. He's much more a tactical player than strategic one. He doesn't have a master plan what he's going to achieve and what is his final objective, but he can react rather quickly, provided he's got that prejudice against American establishment, provided that he's got a lot of suspicion. He's absolutely sure that, for example, in 2014, America attacked Russia when Ukrainian Revolution happened. So that's why anything that could disrupt American institutions in a way could look justified for him. But he's got kind of ideology he wants to adopt, and he wants Russian people to adopt. The only concept of this ideology is that Russia is an empire. Russians should be proud of the fact that he has made Russia great again. He has made Russia an empire again.
Wait a second. That sounds familiar.
Really?
That sounds familiar.
Really? Are you sure? I'm totally sure that Vladimir Putin was the first man to adopt that rhetoric.
So does that mean then that he feels like he has a kindred spirit in Donald Trump? Look, not just the person who was running against the woman he hated, Hillary Clinton, but somebody who views the world in the same way that he does, somebody who's an opportunist like him, somebody who he gets.
Probably, and definitely. And he prefers the politicians with much more cynicism than idealism. From the beginning, Donald Trump, even before he was elected an American president, looked like the man Putin could deal with.
So where we started, Mikhail, this idea that there really isn't this vertically integrated Russian intelligence program from the top of the Kremlin down through FSB that's putting out fake news and interfering in American elections. You say that's not really the reality. If they're not coming from an order from the top, or they're not Russian state policy, what are they?
It should be a bit more complicated, because what we know about FSB, that it's not so effective organization. Usually it is described that the people with KGB background are called the men who send faxes. They are not using even emails. They prefer to keep their secrets off internet because they're afraid of being spy on. They are not that technologically sophisticated. So that operation could not be initiated by FSB. Probably that was some private company closely affiliated with Russian government that could turn up with the initiative, and probably those IT businessmen were willing to appeal to President Putin. They knew that he would love that idea. They thought that was going to be like a gift for him. Probably he could be that adventurous to say, okay, let's try it.
Before we let you go, I'm interested in your view of Donald Trump. When you see somebody in his position with everything that we know or think we know now about Russian interference or possible cooperation, what do you see?
You know, it seems to me that Trump administration is very chaotic, much more chaotic than Putin's. It seems to me that he's not that experienced politician. If he were just affiliated with some Russian business or some Russian company, he would definitely hide that fact. They never tried to conceal anything because probably they were not that experienced, and they were sincerely not aware of the possible consequences. All the businessmen who are supposed to be like negotiating with him are very minor, and that's not true that they are closely related to Vladimir Putin. All his Russian ties are not that impressive.
So then why do you think, and maybe you're speculating, that candidate Trump and to an extent President Trump never wanted to criticize Vladimir Putin and sometimes praised him in a way that to many Americans was shocking because it's Vladimir Putin?
Oh, I don't know, actually. I can't speculate about Putin's way of thinking because I was interviewing people from his inner circle for almost a decade. But unfortunately, I have no information about Trump's way of thinking.
Mikhail Zeger, Russian journalist, author of All the Kremlin's Men Inside the Court of Vladimir Putin, his most recent book, The Empire Must Die. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You can hear an extended version of my conversation with Mikhail Zeger, where we talk about what it's like being a journalist in opposition to Vladimir Putin in Russia. It's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Well, whether or not the Russian campaign to interfere in the election was a highly organized Vladimir Putin operation or not, we do know that most of those efforts were carried out online and on social media. Now, a new report from the U.S. NGO Freedom House says that governments of 30 countries around the world are using, quote, armies of opinion shapers to meddle in elections, advance anti-democratic agendas, and repress their citizens. And that's all happening on the internet. This broad and often frightening use of social media, it all comes as no surprise to journalist David Patrick Arikos. He's written a new book about how social media is changing the face of conflict in our modern era. After years covering conflicts overseas, he says Twitter and Facebook are drastically changing war. From troll farms in Russia pumping out propaganda online to citizens using Facebook to crowdsource arms for battle. The book is called War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. And David is with me now in the studio. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with this question that I covered with Mikhail Zeger. He brought it up too. What is a troll farm and why is it so important in what you're covering, which is modern conflict and modern war?
Well, a troll farm, that's quite an exotic way. I like to think of it as a troll factory, essentially. And the most, you know, famous and prominent one is on a street in St. Petersburg. And what it is literally a factory full of trolls. And they pump out various bits of propaganda. And what is so amazing about this is how organized it is. I mean, they even have floors. So on the first floor, they have journalists writing fake articles. Around the time of the height of the Russia-Ukraine war, they were pretending, you know, they were setting up websites with .ua endings to make it look like they're based in Ukraine. And then on the second floor, they would have people creating memes to spread around. On the third floor, they'd have fake bloggers. So bloggers pretending to be Ukrainians saying, oh, there's no food in the city, kindergartens don't have electricity. And often those bloggers, or they pretend to be Americans saying, we agree with Putin, the whole world supports Russia. And on the fourth floor were the big boys, the Twitter and social media trolls. Mm. And actually, it was a whole merry-go-round of lies, because that fake US blogger, quote-unquote, would often become a source for the fake article being written on the first floor. So why are they important? They're important because the nature of war is changing. And look, propaganda is as old as war itself. But what in traditional warfare, propaganda operations have traditionally supported military operations on the ground. What we're seeing, and this truly is remarkable, is military operations on the ground supporting propaganda operations. Now, look, the Russia-Ukraine conflict is a classic example. Now, under traditional war, you know, Clausewitz, famously the war theorist, said war is the continuation of politics with other means. Now what you're seeing is war as politics itself. So traditionally, war would be two or more sides have a fight in a, you know, a geographical area almost as delineated as a boxing ring. The winner would then impose a political settlement on the loser. Classic example is the Treaty of Versailles after World War One.
This is risk. Move the pieces in and get a surrender.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. But look at Russia in Ukraine. Putin never had any intention of defeating Ukraine, which he easily could have done, and forcing it to the negotiating table. He never had any intention of doing it. What he did instead, and I saw this firsthand, is sent troops across the border to destabilize the Ukraine by destabilizing its east. Now, how did he do this? Not by killing a load of people. Yes, he needed to support separatists. He needed troops to occupy cities of eastern Ukraine. But he did this by Russian state TV and social media promulgating a narrative. And that was that Ukraine was, the government was a fascist junta that wanted to persecute Russian speakers and the Russian people. And essentially, that is a political goal.
And you equate warfare like this with the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, with lots of other conflicts around the world. You say that social media now means that war occupies a gray zone.
Yes.
Between conflict and peace. It's not killing in war and then peacetime. That's gone.
It's not social media alone. It's the fact that the line between war and politics is blurred. Because when Putin is trying to get Eastern Ukrainians to subscribe to a particular narrative. That's a political, not a military goal. I spoke to US and UK soldiers who served in Afghanistan. And in the end, the goal became not to defeat the Taliban, but to get the local population to convince them not to join them. And that's a political goal. So yes, war occupies this gray zone. And, you know, social media means that information can be weaponized to such a degree that, you know, the boundaries between war and peace are blurred. And it's dangerous because if war is indistinguishable from politics, politics never ends. And sort of, you know, we're getting into the stage now. You know, if a soldier today, if a US soldier today dies in Afghanistan, is he a casualty of the 2001 war? The answer is we don't know. And that's the point.
David, so much of your book is about conflict overseas, places like Ukraine, places like Gaza, many other sites of warfare. But it just made me wonder about the United States. It made me wonder about here. I mean, even with our own extremely divisive politics, groups going to the political polls, we think of this country as having enough democratic pressure valves, checks and balances, the Constitution, elections every 2 years, that kind of grind, that kind of conflict, social media fueled conflict like you saw in Ukraine, can't happen here. Can social media ruin that?
I mean, do you mean actual physical conflict? I mean, look, put it this way. What social media does is, you know, we had this great utopian dream that social media, because it connects the world, would bring people together. And to a degree, it has. But it does something else. It splinters them apart. It breaks them apart. And it does this in two ways. The first is obvious. It you know, you can now fight with your opponents online. And you see this with Trump. You saw it in the UK with Brexit. But I'm sure, you know, you've had friends on Facebook unfriend someone else over Trump or over something else. So it makes you know, conflict much easier, and it creates division. The second way, which is more insidious, is that it cocoons us. You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, our friends, quote unquote, on Facebook, they're not all our friends in real life, but
no.
Largely speaking, I'm not saying all your friends, if you're a Democrat, all your friends will be Democrats, or if you're Republican, they'll all be Republicans. But largely speaking, you will be friends with people who have a broad worldview. I mean, you're not going to be friends with a load of Nazis. The algorithm, Facebook algorithm, then calculates what you like and feeds you with yet more content. So you become cocooned in your own world and increasingly unable to see the other point of view. So it creates division, and that is a danger.
Division, but you're also talking about the siloing, which is one of the main conclusions of your book that I find incredibly dangerous and a bit harrowing, but it's an incredible look at the state of modern warfare in the age of social media. David Patrick Arikos, author of War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, earlier in the show, we talked about the connection between domestic violence and gun deaths. Do you think the government or family members should ever be able to take someone's gun away?
Hello, this is Nan Holcomb calling from Seattle. When to take away somebody's guns? I think when they're presenting a clear threat to other people. Back in the 1950s, my dad had to take away the guns that his uncle owned because when he was in his 90s, Uncle Fred started threatening the neighbors. And in that farming community, that was the logical and completely expected response. There was total support for my dad's action. I certainly hope that that is still the case today.
Michael from Macon, Georgia. They should never be able to take your guns unless you're a criminal and have criminal activities, but us everyday, average, law-abiding citizens keep our guns so we can protect ourselves and others.
We want to know what you think. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway and be part of our conversation on this show. That's why we're here. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton. or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.